So that's why I wrote the prologue on proving God. I wrote that primarily for Baha'is, to show them that it is in fact legitimate for Baha'is to prove the existence of God, because it seems that many Baha'is feel that this is not legitimate, or that this is somehow a sign of a lack of faith that we should prove that God exists. What it actually says, just let me say this, that if we look at the quotes from Abdu'l-Bahá, we see that there's a three-stage process. Let's just look at this briefly. You see, he says on page 2, day and night you must strive that you attain to the significances of the heavenly kingdom. Perceive the signs of divinity. Acquire certainty of knowledge and realize that this world has a creator, a vivifier, a provider, an architect. Knowing this through proofs and evidences and not through susceptibilities. What's a susceptibility? It's an emotional feeling, right? It's an emotional feeling. Nay, rather through decisive arguments and real vision. That is to say, visualizing it as clearly as the outer eye beholds the sun. In this way, may you behold the presence of God and attain to the knowledge of the holy divine manifestation. So this is quite far from warm, fuzzy feelings, right? I mean, decisive arguments, real vision. Clearly, you know, this is not, you know, gee, that felt good, you know. And then he says, if thou wishest the divine knowledge and recognition. Now this, if you want to know God, right, we're talking about pursuing an authentic relationship with God. Well, the first thing you have to do is know that there is a God before you can establish a relationship with him. If thou wishest the divine knowledge and recognition, purify thy heart from all beside God. Be wholly attracted to the ideal beloved one. So, first, purify the heart. Search for and choose him, and apply thyself to rational and authoritative arguments. For arguments are a guide to the path, and by this the heart will be turned to the Sun of Truth. And, third stage, when the heart is turned into the Sun of Truth, then the eye will be open and will recognize the Sun through the Sun itself. That's a relationship, direct relationship with God. Then man will be in no need of arguments or proofs, for the Son is altogether independent, and absolute independence is in need of nothing. And proofs are one of the things of which absolute independence has no need. Now, I'm sure you all know this passage. It's very widely quoted. To just do the last thing, oh well, when I know God directly, when I know the Son directly, then I have no need of proofs. So since I already believe in God, I'm a Baha'i, I don't have any need of proofs. But notice that Abdu'l-Bahá gives a three-stage process. So I'm just, since I took time to write this, I'm just reading from myself here on page 3. These counsels of Abdu'l-Bahá are representative of the harmony between mind and heart that is found throughout the Baha'i writings. They describe a process that begins with the purification of the heart, proceeds to rational and authoritative arguments, and then results in a heartfelt conviction coupled with an objective knowledge and perception of the truth. Why, one might well ask, should one purify the heart before undertaking the search for rational arguments? Well, I'll let you read the answer to that. As I say, it recalls very much the tablet to the true seeker. Remember in the Kitab-e-Iqan when Baha'u'llah says, but O my brother, when a true seeker determines to take the step of search in the path leading to the knowledge of the Ancient of Days, he must before all else cleanse and purify his heart. And then so on. So the same three-part process is, first you purify your heart, second you apply yourself to rational and authoritative arguments, and this, as he says, will turn the heart towards the sun, and then the eye will be open and we recognize the sun through itself, and we become independent of the need for arguments, and so on. This is when we have established this authentic relationship with God. I mean, once you've established this authentic relationship, you don't need to go back and prove it over and over again. I mean, you've already been through that. But the point is, this relationship is a result of having gone through the process. I mean, he tells you how to do it, but I think often Baha'is sort of look and say, as I say, I'm a believer, I already know that God exists, and so why should I worry about proofs of God's existence? Then maybe something happens later on, and they have tests, and they lose their faith, or they leave the faith, or whatever. And so maybe when we see this process going on, as we see it going on, people losing their faith, or leaving the faith, or having doubts, we should wonder, well, did they really understand who God was and that he exists? Not through susceptibilities, but objectively, independently. Because, in other words, if I know objectively, independently, in other words, I'm not suddenly going to deny my belief in the law of gravity, right? In other words, I may not like the law of gravity, but I know by God that gravity works. And I, no matter what happens to me, right, no matter what tests I have in life, once I know how the law of gravity works, it would never occur to me to deny the law of gravity, right? I mean, that would just be stupid. What's that going to get me anywhere, you know? So in the same way, if I know that God exists, and the nature of God, which can also be proved. I give proofs of the nature of God. In fact, proofs that God is infinitely loving and infinitely kind and so on. If I know that God exists and loves us with the same degree of objectivity that I know the law of gravity functions, then no matter what happens to me, I'm never going to deny that. I mean, it's not an option, it's not a question, because it's not that I believe that God exists, I know that God exists, you see? And this is one thing I suggest in this essay, as you'll read, is that we should change the language of religion from a language of belief to a language of knowledge. You see, religion is knowledge. Abdu'l-Bahá says that religion is that essential connection which emanates from the realities of things. Then later on, when he defines science, he says science is that essential connection which emanates from the realities of things. So he gives in different places the same definition for science that he gives for religion. Well, let's read that. This is in the causality principle. He says on page 122, I'm reading first to put it into context for myself. Thus, in the Baha'i conception, religion, like science, is most correctly viewed as a knowledge-generating enterprise rather than a belief-affirming or rule-making enterprise. So again, you have to think, to what extent do you unconsciously perhaps think of religion or the Baha'i faith as a belief-affirming or a rule-generating enterprise? But it's not. It is a knowledge-generating enterprise. It generates real knowledge, I mean, about how the world really functions. You know, plain old practical knowledge. And so then I quote from Abdu'l-Bahá, religion is the essential connection which proceeds from the realities of things. It is the necessary connection which emanates from the reality of things. Now if you go back and read Plato and Aristotle and Descartes and Leibniz, you will see that this is the same definition that all the classic philosophers gave of truth. You know, what is truth? They said truth is that essential connection which is inherent in the nature of things. That's what truth is. You know, so religion is truth. That's all. Science is truth. I mean, religion and science are just two names we give for two different processes of attaining truth. And truth is one. So then Abdu'l-Bahá says, briefly, the supreme manifestations of God are aware of the reality of the mysteries of beings. Therefore, they establish laws which are suitable and adapted to the state of the world of man. The supreme manifestations of God are aware of the mysteries of beings. Therefore, they understand this essential connection emanating from the reality of things, and by this knowledge establish the law of God. So the first time in the Baha'i faith, we also have an adequate understanding of the nature of revelation itself. The Christian paradigm of revelation was, of course, that God, the eternal pre-existent essence, becomes wholly incarnate in the person of a physical human being, which is Jesus Christ. Spiritual world, material world. And the guardian and the dispensation qualifies this doctrine of incarnation as fantastic and crude. He says this crude and fantastic doctrine of the incarnation. The Muslims, on the other hand, viewed the Prophet as an ordinary man who is the vehicle of revelation. So whereas the Christians believed in the pre-existence of Jesus, in other words, Jesus is identified with the essence of God who's eternally pre-existent, and so they come to the what's known as Christology, that is a theology about the nature of Christ, namely that Christ is the pre-existent God himself, the Catholic notion of the Trinity. What the Muslims say is that the Quran was eternally pre-existent, that the Quran is directly from God, and so God was here and the Quran always existed as the Word of God. All right, so this was the Quran, if you will, which was generated by the Word of God, but which was eternally pre-existent. And this Quran was transmitted through the vehicle of Muhammad. But Muhammad was just an ordinary man who was chosen to be a vehicle of revelation. Well, maybe this is some of your conception of the revelation of Baha'u'llah. You see, because some people think, some people misunderstand the station of distinction of the manifestation, thinking that this means that he has a weak human nature and also this revelation, and so that sometimes we're interacting with his weak human nature and sometimes we're interacting with his nature. But in my brother's essays, in particular his long essay on the doctrine of the most great infallibility, utterly refutes this notion. It's very clear from the writings, as I've already said yesterday in my discussion of the levels of reality, that the manifestation is created in a state of absolute perfection. So the manifestation, like God, has all knowledge. So every feigned ignorance of the manifestation is simply a pedagogical device that he uses to teach us. In other words, by identifying himself sometimes with weak and sinful humanity, he speaks with our voice. And he uses this as a pedagogical device. So some of us have misunderstood that and think that that means that the manifestation shares this sinful or weak nature. But that's not the case. That's not the case. The manifestation is perfect at all times. He has all knowledge. And so here we see that Abdu'l-Bahá says this, that further on he says, knowledge is of two kinds. One is subjective and the other objective. That is to say, an intuitive knowledge and a knowledge derived from perception. The knowledge of things which men universally have is gained by reflection and evidence. So this is scientific knowledge. This is the bottom-up process I described yesterday. The circle of this knowledge is very limited. As I said yesterday, science gives you an exact description, exact knowledge, but of a limited portion of reality. But the second sort of knowledge, which is the knowledge of being, is intuitive. It is like the cognizance and consciousness that man has of himself. In other words, it's like self-awareness. So you don't have to go to school, you don't have to make an effort to know that you exist. So this is the nature of consciousness. Consciousness is a primary intuition of being. Now, since everything else we know is mediated to us through our consciousness, then consciousness is the most fundamental characteristic of the human being. In other words, what distinguishes us most from animals or any other form of existence is that we are self-aware, that we have consciousness. And what is consciousness? Consciousness is the most primary thing there is. In other words, consciousness cannot be analyzed in terms of anything else, because consciousness is a primary intuition of being itself. It is the immediate perception of existence, and in particular of your existence. Now, historically, the first person to realize fully the primacy of consciousness in this way was Descartes, at least the first that I know of. Okay, and his brilliant thing, I mean, he's the one who said, "I think, therefore I am," which you could interpret, or you could say what he really means is, "I am aware that I exist, therefore I exist," which was an absolutely brilliant move, in which I use in the prologue on Proofs of the Existence of God. I mean, well, this was stunningly brilliant on Descartes' part. I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. You know, so he starts out with complete doubt. He says, let's doubt everything, because this was the old solipsis argument. Well, everything is relative, everything is mediated through human subjectivity, so how do I know that anything exists? Maybe everything is an illusion. Maybe everything is an illusion. So Descartes addresses this so-called solipsis fallacy by saying, okay, suppose everything's an illusion. Then I am aware that these illusions, I have these illusions. There must be then, since I'm conscious of these illusions, then I must exist. Because something has to exist to have consciousness of these illusions. So everything is an illusion. So I am aware of all these illusions, and therefore I exist. He gave this fundamental argument then that awareness of existence implies existence. We could exist without being aware of it, but we can't be aware that we exist without existing. This is what Abdu'l Baha is saying. The second sort of knowledge is intuitive, like the cognizance and consciousness that man has of himself. This knowledge is not the outcome of effort and study. It is an existing thing, an absolute gift. That's why I say that consciousness is primary. It cannot be resolved into anything else. It is an absolute gift. In other words, it doesn't depend or derive from anything else. Now, he says, since the sanctified realities, the supreme manifestations of God, surround the essence and qualities of the creatures, transcend and contain existing realities and understand all things, therefore their knowledge is divine knowledge and not acquired. That is to say, it is a holy bounty, it is divine revelation. In other words, continuing in my own words, in the same way that ordinary human beings have the spontaneous knowledge of their own being and existence, the manifestations of God are endowed with the spontaneous knowledge of the laws of all being. You see. So just as you have the spontaneous knowledge of your existence, the fact of your existence, Baha'u'llah, the manifestations, have this same kind of spontaneous knowledge of everything, of all of the laws of reality, of the laws of all being, of all existence. So So the manifestation is not like a helpless channel who just transmits this stuff. Now, such a thing is possible, and we have experiences of this. You know, there's a story, for example, in the memoirs of Salman the Barber, that, you know, he had served Baha'u'llah, and at one point he asked, Baha'u'llah asked him, we give you leave to ask a favor of us, you know. So said Salman the Barber, said, yeah, I can ask a favor? He said, yes, any favor you want, we will grant you. So he says, well, he said, I've always wanted to be a poet. Okay, this is in the memoirs, you can read it. It was published by Kalimat Press a few years ago. So he says, I would like to be a poet. And so Baha'u'llah said, okay, your wish is granted. And so in the next days, he began to compose this marvelous poetry. And he described, Salman the Barber described, he said, I didn't even understand what I was writing, you know, but I could do this, you know. So this is an example of that kind of inspiration or revelation, if you will. In other words, where a person is a vehicle, it's coming through him, but he, you know, it's not in any sense from him. But this is not the revelation that the manifestations have. They have the knowledge. They have them. Well, I invite you to read my brother's essay on the doctrine of the most great infallibility. He gives numerous quotes, and you will see that this is quite clear from the writings. That the manifestation then has this knowledge. He's not just a helpless, passive human vehicle of revelation. Which, as I say, tends to be the Muslim view of revelation. Okay? All right. Now, we talked about abandoning or renouncing the search for power, the pursuit of power, and replacing it by the pursuit of love. And we said that the means of pursuing love is to use power to establish justice. You cannot move. I mean, this is something which many philosophers have realized for years. The existentialists realized it very clearly. It's very clear in the writings of Kierkegaard, for example. You cannot move from power to love without passing through justice. I mean, you can't do it, okay? So justice is like the key to love. You can't change from a power orientation to a love orientation without going through justice. Because justice is the means of establishing love and thus authentic relationship. So we have to reverse the paradigm. In other words, the goal is now to achieve authentic relationships with God and with others. What this means is increasing your capacity to love genuinely and to receive love, to give and receive love. We have to remember that both of these are part of exactly the same process. A person who cannot receive love cannot give love either. So receiving love is just as important as giving love, but they're really the same thing. I mean, there's no difference. Which is not to say that receiving love is the same thing as being the object of love. Receiving is an active thing, okay? So one can be the object of love without receiving the love. Love me that I may love thee. If thou lovest me not, my love can in no wise reach thee. So we're all the object of the love of God, but we do not all receive the love of God. Okay? Now, so we pursue authentic relationships, which as we've seen is the very purpose of our existence and is the very purpose of religion. And since that is now the goal, we need means to attain the goal. And what are the means? The means are developing our powers, our capacities, particularly of knowledge of love and will, of knowledge, love and will. In the process of achieving well-being and autonomy, so in other words, we actualize these capacities of knowing the truth, of loving the beautiful, and willing the just or the good by increasing our well-being and autonomy. So as our powers increase, we deploy these powers to establish justice. And as I say, when we establish justice, when we do this, well, I started to say that love is a gift from God, but justice is also a gift from God. So we can't even say that we establish justice. But if we make a sincere effort to use our powers to establish justice, then if we are sincere, God accepts the sincerity of our effort and establishes justice for us. Okay? That's what really happens. All right? Remember, powerfulness is an illusion. We don't really have any power. Okay? We don't have any power. But when we sincerely strive, to deploy our God-given capacities for the establishment of justice, if we are sincere, God will accept the sincerity and will help us establish justice. And then from the establishment of justice, there flows love. The capacity to love, with our mind and with our heart and our actions completely. And so we can make a simple equation. Unity, which as we all know is the goal of the Baha'i Faith, is love plus justice. I mean, that's what unity is. You see, why isn't unity just justice? It's not just justice because justice alone would be simply a formal relationship with no dynamics. Which is sort of comparable to, say, the secular legal system, right? In which you try to have laws and you really want to be justice, but the human dimension is absent. And so we see that all sorts of hurts are done to people in the name of justice, even though people are sincerely trying to establish justice, because the secular law is such a blunt instrument. I mean, that there's just no way of doing this justice without love and mercy. And so that's why in the Baha'i system of law, for example, we have this principle that every case is dealt with on its own merits, for example. Which means that, yes, the local assembly can remove your voting rights because you got married without parents' permission, and it cannot remove the voting rights of Jane or John who did the same thing, because it judges that there are other circumstances involved in Jane or John's case that don't apply to your case. So in secular law, this would be impossible. If you have two identical infractions, then you have to apply the same identical punishment. But in Baha'i law, you don't, because the assembly is free to make this determination, this judgment, which may be wrong, of course, but it can be appealed to the House of Justice. But the House of Justice, let's say, to take up that, can make the determination that in case A, yes, this infraction occurred, in fact, but we apply no sanction. In case B, the same infraction occurred, and we apply a sanction. And this is absolute justice because it comes from the House of Justice, which is infallible. It comes from God. So, so just justice is not unity, and just love is not unity either, because there can be the giving of love. A person can be a loving person, but if this love is not reciprocated, then there is not necessarily justice. Love can exist in an asymmetrical relationship, but justice implies a symmetry in the relationship. So for example, I mean, let's just make it very clear. I can love a dog. Presumably Barbara loves her dog. I like dogs, but I don't think a dog is my equal. Okay, so love, genuine love, does not imply a reciprocal relationship, an equal relationship. But between mature human beings, love and respect does imply a completely reciprocal relationship, you see. So love can exist in the absence of justice. It cannot flourish in the absence of justice. If justice is not established, this love will eventually be killed. So let's give an example of that, a very simple example. John and Jane fall madly in love with each other and they get married. And they're genuinely in love with each other, and you know how it is when you're in love. All you think about is satisfying the other person's needs. All you think about is getting their approval by making them happy. So you each think of making the other happy. You think of all the little ways that you can get that smile of approval and happiness on the other person's lips. But over time, injustices may creep into this relationship. Love is a matter of giving and receiving, but it may happen in this relationship that it evolves in such a way that one person does more of the giving and the other does more of the receiving. So let's say after 10 years that this has happened to John and Jane. Let's say that it has come in a position where Jane is still constantly thinking of satisfying John's needs, but John has become absorbed in satisfying his own needs, and he doesn't think very much about satisfying Jane's needs. So what will happen? Well, this is an asymmetrical relationship. All the giving is going one way. Jane is giving to John, but John isn't giving back to Jane. So that's unjust. It's not lack of love, okay? It's not lack of love, but it's unjust. So what's going to happen? Well, you know what's going to happen. We see it every day. Jane is going to start feeling resentments. At first, she's going to suppress these resentments. She's going to say, well, do I love John? Sure I love John. I mean, look, my whole life is built around this man. I love him. So why should I feel these resentments? Why should I feel this anger? Why should I feel hate for somebody I love? So she's saying, well, it's just my weakness and so on, and she's going to suppress this, but it's going to grow and grow and grow. And so finally, it's going to grow to a point where she sits down one day and says, we can't go on like this anymore. We have to talk about this. And John is going to say, well, I thought everything was great, you know? I thought everything was fine. Okay. Well, sure, he thought everything was fine. He was getting all the love and he was giving nothing in return. Everything was great as far as he was concerned. So then, you know, well, you never said anything before about this. Why all of a sudden now? Well, no matter why I didn't say anything before, I'm now saying it, and we've got a problem, and I've got to deal with it. Well, so you know what will happen. Either they will deal with it, they will get counseling, and what will they do to heal the relationship? John will have to learn how not to take Jane for granted. He will have to learn how to sacrifice some of his needs for her need. In other words, they will have to put justice in the relationship. And if they succeed in putting justice back in the relationship, then love will be reborn and flourish. This is what God always does. If we sincerely establish justice, he will give us the gift of love. This is the promise that is there. Again, we do not have the power in and of ourselves to love. Again, if you don't believe this, make yourself love where you don't love. Choose anything that you don't love and will yourself to love it, and you'll see that you do not have the power to love at will. You simply do not have this power. You cannot make yourself love where you don't love, but a sheer act of will. Okay? Yeah.
What about, I'm thinking of Brilliant Star, the little magazine for kids.
Right.
And it's got a love plan in it. And it helps kids, and it helps adults as well.
Good.
To take the object of hatred, and to, by going through a cognitive process of six steps, to reframe and to think differently about this object to develop love. Much like, really, I think Abdu'l-Bahá's admonition to stop a thought of hate with a thought of love.
Yeah, sounds good.
So how does that fit in with that we cannot will ourselves?
Well, there you're establishing a process of establishing justice, of thinking about this object in a more complete and a just way. So you're teaching the child how to establish justice, how to use his powers of thought to establish justice and therefore to change the way he feels. So that's not willing himself to love, you know. Yes, you want to say that? That's right.
And I was thinking that you will yourself to love through the help of God, but not just through your own.
Yeah, no, when I say you can't will yourself to love, that doesn't mean that you can't sincerely desire to love and to initiate a process. That's what I'm saying. You use your powers, you deploy your powers of will and of heart and of mind to establish justice, which... And then God, as I say, gives us the gift of love when we do that. So sure, in order to pursue that, we have to want it, of course. And if you say, yeah, it would be great if I could love, you know, no, you have to pursue it. I mean, with a lot of energy, sure. Yes.
From what I'm understanding from the conversation, will on its own, it cannot create change and transformation.
That's right, nothing on its own can. It's an integrated process, and you can see this, I talk about this in, let's point this out in the book, in the concept of spirituality, this little feedback loop here that exists on page 227 of knowledge, love, faith, intentionality, action, reaction. So there I talk about knowledge, love, and will. And I explained that this is certainly an integrated process. Sure, nothing on its own, just the knowledge on its own won't do it either. Or just the attraction to it, the love for the goal will not do it either. It's an integrated process. Sure, absolutely. Okay, so this is what we have to do. The question is, what is going to motivate us to do this? What is going to allow us to renounce power? Now, so far we have described what it is that we have to do. We have to renounce the pursuit of power. But how do we do this? Well, this is what we will talk about after the break. Okay. Okay. So, we understand that reversing this whole process, reversing this pyramid, renouncing the pursuit of power and replacing it by the pursuit of love, or what I've called, which is the same thing, the pursuit of authentic relationships, is what this is all about. Now, the question comes then, why have we pursued power? Why do we pursue power? And the basic answer is because we do not understand what we are. We do not have a concept of our intrinsic value. You see, if we go back, this is why I went through the sort of metaphysical stuff yesterday. What is the human being? As we say, each human being is a soul that is created by God, with capacities given by God. This must be my copy. Now, you all know these statements, but let's just read these over. These are from the Gleanings in various places. This is on page 205 of the Pink Book. The incomparable Creator hath created all men from one same substance, and hath exalted their reality above the rest of his creatures. Again, man is the highest thing in creation. Process is the result of 500 million years of random evolution. So what you are is just the product of a thermodynamical system. You're just an accident of heredity. And so there you are, this little pitiable creature, the accident of heredity. And so for better or worse, you struggle through life with your various interactions. If you happen to have good parents who give you love and so on, then that's great. But if you happen to have other things, then you've had it, and so on and so on. So some people are favorable, but most people aren't. And so life is a pretty dreary affair, but it's the only one we have, and so we have to make the best of it. And so we have to have lots of sporting events and TV and beer and everything to make everybody happy, while the few of us who have real talent go around doing the really significant things, while the masses of ordinary people just slog it out.